This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The economy seems to teeter on the edge of breakdown week to week. Fukushima rolls on. Climate scientists are pretty sure we are on our way to catastrophe. That and a whole lot more is always lurking in the back of our minds. So in the great scheme of things, what kind of doomer are you? What kind of doomer are you? Time to make a choice, my friend. What kind of doomer are you? How do you think it's going to end? Dirty and doomed. What kind of doomer are you? Time to make a choice, my friend. What kind of doomer are you? How do you think it's going to end? Albert Bates has a chart to sort out some of the leading alternative thinkers. Albert is a former lawyer, longtime resident of the farm in Tennessee, and a well-known speaker and writer about everything from alternative energy to permaculture. Mr. Bates, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. I'm glad to be back.
Well, it's hard to sort out what to do and who to listen to. You've been mixing with some counterculture greats for a long time. Why did you decide to chart out the players again?
I think that this was all started by some deep thinking by a few different players, David Holmgren in particular, Rob Hopkins, Peter Harper, who were, you know, wondering, you know, let's put this to the scientific test. How effective are we really in halting climate change and global catastrophe, whether you call it financially or from peak everything or whatever the source of it is? We seem like a very small and impotent movement overall. Why is that, and what can we do to change it? And so I started looking at all of the spectrum of strategies out there and started to put those into a mind map that might make it easier to grasp.
Did David Holmgren really explain why he made such a big change, and what did he now propose?
I don't know that it's a really big change, but he wrote an essay a few months ago called Crash on Demand. And his shift essentially was, you know, he had written earlier about the permaculture needs to test itself. It needs to ask hard questions of itself. It should be writing for peer-reviewed journals. It should be putting itself into greater scientific scrutiny. And so following along from that line of thinking, he started to ask hard questions of the strategy of earth care and people care, and are we really succeeding on a global basis? And so his Crash on Demand essay was really focused on that, and the change that he was suggesting was, if you look at his four scenarios, he had developed the idea many years ago, and it's in his book Permaculture that came out early after the 2000. And his four scenarios were that we could go in four possible directions. We could go in the direction of brown tech, which is, you know, fracking, more nuclear power, high-tech solutions, putting patches on the problems that keep coming up. We could go into green tech, which is more solar and renewables and, you know, bioregionalism, agrarianism, working at a regional level to try to implement solutions. We could go into earth stewardship, which is sort of the path of permaculture, working locally to regenerate and heal damaged systems and to help nature heal herself, and in that way to improve on the underlying support systems for all of us. And then finally, there's a lifeboat strategy, which is saying, well, we're not going to succeed here. We better just prepare whatever little cocoon we can, because what's coming is a very serious storm, and we should all be much better prepared for that. Those are his four scenarios. Well, he came to the conclusion last year that brown tech is really winning. The fracking is now spreading from North America to Europe. It's going to go into Asia. It's going to go into Australia. And as a result, and partly because of the tendency of Western civilization to see the earth as an unlimited resource and pollution as something that can be dealt with technologically, and that we have this idea that technology uber alles, it can conquer everything, that we're going to go into brown tech, and that's the worst possible outcome because it will really extend and worsen whatever it needs to come to change and heal. And it's going to make it much harder for us to heal because it's going to push the Earth into a collapse paradigm that may not be survivable, at least by the two-leggeds. And so his solution really was, let's go more into green tech, and how do we do that? Well, we're going to have to disengage from brown tech, and we should really be adamant on this. We need to ask permaculturists, we need to engage young people to just say no to brown tech and disengage from the entire global economy by going local as much as possible, growing your own food, having your own solar energy, doing whatever you need to do. And then by that simple act, if enough of us do it, we'll crash the global economy. And that's really where he started to ruffle feathers, and that's what started the whole kerfuffle that we're writing about now.
So what is a collapse, Nick?
Well, I tried to call, to categorize people into whether they believed in collapse or not, and that was fairly easy. There's a lot of people out there on different websites and writing books and in documentary films that are actually saying pretty clearly that we have too many excess claims on underlying real wealth, to put it in terms that Nicole Foss is fond of using, that we've overtapped the ability of the Earth to regenerate. And it's now in a serious decline phase, and it's going to take us all with it. And whether you initiator is finance, or whether the initiator is peak oil, or whether the initiator is climate change, we don't really know or even care that much about. We just know that it's all going to collapse. It's a house of cards, and we're in a strong wind now. It's not going to last much longer. So within that group, you've got Nicole Foss, you've got Dmitry Orlov, you've got Mike Rupert, Colin Baker, David Korowitz in Ireland, Jim Kunstler, James Howard Kunstler, John Michael Greer, and Guy McPherson, just to name a few. And I would, add a few to that, like maybe fencenicks might be a better term. People who are not really committing to collapse, there might still be a thread of hope somehow to avoid or avert collapse if we suddenly made some massive changes. And I would include in that Richard Heinberg, myself, Charlie Hall, who does the energy return on investment analysis, and a few others who are hopeful that there may actually be some time if we were to make some significant changes. But I would distinguish collapsenics from utopians. Utopians would be those who are like Amory Lovins or Ray Kurzweil, who think that technology will take a giant leap, or that we'll become so much more vastly efficient with our use of energy that we can, in fact, continue civilization as we know it for another century or more, or in the case of Kurzweil, maybe even transubstantiate into something much less dependent on the physical world, like some kind of foglets drifting off into technological cyberspace.
And we're starting to collect some scientists in the doomer corner. I won't even talk about James Hansen, but look at Tim Garrett from the University of Utah. He wrote a peer-reviewed paper showing that only an economic crash could bring the massive reduction of greenhouse gas emissions we need to prevent 4 degrees or more of warming. So it isn't just paranoia to think that civilization needs to go down, would you say?
No, I agree with that. And certainly Naomi Klein in a recent essay pointed out that same thing, that scientists are coming out and saying very clearly that we're on a path that leads to utter destruction. And the only way short of that is to essentially shift our entire economy from one of growth to one of rapid degrowth. And to do that will be displacing. It will change the way that people do business. And this is serious, worth considering, and worth thinking about very hard at the highest levels of government. And unfortunately, those scientists are voices crying in the wilderness and no one is listening to them.
And I notice another famous scientist on your chart down in the doom corner, and that's Kevin Anderson. He's the deputy director of the Tyndall Center for Climate Change Research in the UK, and Radio EcoShock broadcast his famous speech of November 6, 2012. What is Anderson saying, you think, and why is he in your corner, and is he different from James Lovelock?
Yeah, it was more prosaic and talking about that in 4 years we'll all be in Greenland or the Arctic in small bands of roving nomads, those that survive. And I don't think Anderson has said anything like that yet. But I think that he's certainly one of those who's raising a voice like Jim Hansen, calling for a mass movement of people to change the way that governments are working. You know, there are others within the system, like I would mention some of the new economists like Herman Lee and Robert Costanza, who are also working within existing paradigms to say that we could change our economic systems to systems that would be much better, and we could live much better lives. But we'd have to look at what the Earth's carrying capacity truly is, and we have to think about population. We have to think about how we extract resources and how we reuse them afterwards. All of these things can go into a system that's based on well-being for humans. It's actually the central people care pillar of permaculture. And we could do this in ways that are rigorous and are doable and they're strategic, and they can be done in a timely fashion. So I think there is this division between people who say it's going to collapse, just go ahead and step out of the way or expedite it if you can, and people who are saying, well, it doesn't have to if we suddenly were to make a huge shift.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
You are listening to the Radio EcoShock Show. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Albert Bates. We're talking about the Four Corners of Doom. You mentioned a name I didn't recognize at all. Who the heck is Robert Costanza?
Robert Costanza is formerly at the University of Maryland, and now he's a visiting professor at Griffin University in Australia. I'll send you a PDF, and you can put it up on your website. How about that? It's Robert Costanza's most recent paper for Nature, in which he looks at a lot of the things like income distribution and the gross national product indicators and indexes, and how can we actually change it to a well-being index instead of a gross index, and thereby shift the entire frame. And he's putting this into terms that could be understood by the summit in Davos right now, or the people in Switzerland who are arguing that we should all have a minimum income, not have to be competing all the time, that sort of thing. I think that kind of new thinking in economics, Steve Keen does some of this too, talking about jubilees, talking about forgiveness of debt, talking about the idea of shifting from an economy that's based on demanding competition, demanding rapid extraction and exhaustion of the world's resources in a competitive mode, instead of that, shifting over to what do we actually need for people to be happy and to live good, healthy lives. And if you shift that frame just that little bit, you can actually develop systems that work pretty well.
And then we have people with really different views, and this is where Derek Jensen and I part ways. In Vancouver a few years ago, I recorded a speech of his. He bragged about dynamite and his AK-47 assault rifle. I think the whole system, particularly in America, is designed to overreact to any sniff of violence. It just makes things warlike and worse, in my opinion, just like after 9/11. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'm with you. I have been having this argument with Derek Jensen for a number of years. And Nicole Foss put it very well to David Holmgren. She said, don't make yourself a scapegoat. It's silly, because when things do come crashing down, and they're bound to, they're going to look around for people who are the cause of it. They're going to be there looking after the people who are the bearers of bad news and made the predictions. And don't make yourself a scapegoat. Orloff had another idea. Dmitry Orloff, his basic thing was, check your math, okay, David Holmgren, you who say that science should lead our decisions in permaculture, check your own math. We're too few. We're only, you know, we're not barely even 1%, never mind 10%. How is that going to change anything if we try to crash the world's systems on demand? It simply can't be done. So from that standpoint, you want to be in a way that's relatively harmless and is seen as being harmless, because you don't have a chance of going against the world's militaries. You don't have a chance of toppling anything by violence. The only way that you're going to do anything that's viral and that actually moves quickly is by coming up with a really good idea and having it spread, which gets me to something that I drum that I beat constantly, which is, if it's not fun, ain't nobody going to do it. This was my whole thing of the post-petroleum survival guide that I wrote back in 2006. You've got to make transition fun. You've got to make a change to a better future better. It has to be fun. It has to be something that people will enjoy doing. Those are the kinds of things that get viral. Those are the things that spread quickly. It was music that changed things in Africa. It was music that drove the civil rights movement, music and dance. So we need to actually have that kind of spirit to get infused into our movements, and that's how we're going to really change things.
It's funny you say that. You know, I'm just starting to work away at learning how to produce music myself, and it's dance music that I like, so maybe I'm on to some meme there. You know, another thing I wanted to talk to you about, Albert, I don't agree that humans are going to go extinct anytime soon. We're tough. We're very adaptable. We're hard to get rid of. But the idea of near-term extinction has picked up speed ever since Dr. Guy McPherson started adding up a whole bunch of those positive feedback effects. And I'm glad he did, because hardly anybody's doing that. What's your opinion on this near-term extinction?
I've had these discussions with Guy McPherson as well, and I've gone over all of his different studies, and I don't disagree. I basically see the same trends that he sees, but my distinction there is that there are gray areas, and I'll take Arctic methane as one of those gray areas. We have some near-term data that's quite alarming, but it takes a study of a decade or more to really come to conclusions whether these are short-term results or long-term results. And so I'm holding out that hopefully what we've seen in the near-term trends are not going to be extended much farther. I don't know that that's a valid hope, but I certainly have it. And so I don't really go with John McPherson yet. As long as I'm in this sinking ship and I have a can, I'm going to start bailing and keep working in that direction. And that's kind of the direction of permaculture. And I would throw in here, you know, if people don't yet know what permaculture is, it's real easy to learn. It's a design science that helps you put frameworks into things and make your life a little bit better. And so we're giving courses in permaculture. We've been doing that here in Tennessee for a number of years. I would tell people to avoid free courses because those tend to be just commercial trash and they lead you to spend money that you didn't expect to. But I think that there are lots of courses being offered in permaculture, and anybody who hasn't already taken that opportunity to learn permaculture should start doing that. And that's one thing you get out of David Holmgren.
Well, I was going to ask you about whether we could really do any better than just to head for the hills or head for the jungle. And then I remembered you are heading for the jungle with a permaculture course. Do you want to tell us about that?
I'm going down to Belize next week. I'm going to be there for the month of February, or at least the first half, where we teach an annual course in at the Maya Mountain Research Farm. And this is an opportunity for people to actually see in a working farm that's been going for 25 years how you can provide for all of your food and other needs from growing long-term perennial plants that net sequester carbon. And they're making biochar while they're cooking their meals, and they've got a complete holistic system. So it's a really good place to learn permaculture, mmrfbz.org, and I'll provide that link for your site. I'll also mention that we have an Indiegogo campaign that's active right now. I'm trying to build our eco-village training center to have an eco-hostel here at the farm. So here at the farm where we've been going for 40-some years, we actually have some very good systems already in place, and people who are in North America and want to see something that very closely relates to their environment might want to come down and stay at our eco-hostel. If you want to do that, help me build it. I'm doing apprenticeship and volunteer programs all this year, and also our Indiegogo campaign. We've got some very nice perks. You can have lifetime stays, or you can just have weekend discounts. Just come and take a look at our Indiegogo campaign for your in at the farm.
Well, it's been a long time dream of mine to get there, and I'm sure I will someday, and I hope to find you there. Now, meanwhile, in your blog at peaksurfer.blogspot.ca, you reproduce a super chart by Dave Pollard, and I love some of the slogans that typify each position. We have everything from preparation and community might save us to smash or undermine civilization now to diminish its damage. And Pollard divides his groups into collapsenecks and salvationists, and I have the feeling that collapsenecks get the most hits on the internet. But the idea of saving ourselves is probably more popular in the hearts of most people. What are your thoughts on that?
Dave Pollard, he was thinking hard about democracy and how is it that people can bring about change and do it in a way that improves the process so we don't go down these cul-de-sacs in future civilizations, assuming we get that far. So when Pollard was looking at Graeber's work and trying to assess it, he began to think about all these different categories of players, the transition and resilience movement, human or involved with human consciousness, you know, globalists, people who are into the rapture, you know, the religious extremes, deniers, the people who are like the Koch brothers and are actually spending money to stop change, and then people who are on the ground like communitarians and deep green activists and people who are neo-survivalists going out there and trying to make a new living in the countryside. So looking at all those different groups, he grouped them into collapseniks and salvation. And he put the technophobes, the people who thought technology was going to save us, in the category of salvationists, meaning, you know, they're actually religious. It's a religious dogma that they're adhering to, not so much reality. And actually, the deep green activists have it right. They see what's actually happening, and they may be, you can call them collapseniks, but they're actually realists.
And the other thing, I was thinking about a chart like yours, it seems like a menu of people we can tune into, almost like a radio station, but this is really serious stuff. Is there a process where each of us, our listeners and you and I, can figure out who we are in this perspective?
I haven't done that yet, but I had a couple offers, you know, commenters who are very technologically adept commented on my post. And said, you know, we could do a JavaScript system here where people could make a slider that would move around and put them in different positions and they could see what the results might be, maybe in terms of their carbon footprint or those kinds of things, and who they keep company with based on a series of indicators. I think you can do that just on your own. And most of us are sort of undecided at this point. You kind of have to have one foot in the last century and one foot in the next one, and you don't really know where the world is headed at this moment, so you kind of try to hedge your bets and prepare as best you can. I don't know that any of us has really settled into a hard position. I did have a few here that were essayists and book writers that are in hard positions, but David Holmgren illustrates that even a fairly hard position can shift, and it puts him in a new quadrant, a new group of cohorts.
Some people, once they take a position, then they want to diss or get rid of all the other people who aren't in the same place they are. I'm not like that. I think that human beings are very different, and we need all of the different voices to be able to sort this out. I think diversity is good at this point in time.
I agree. Diversity is naturally an indicator of biological health in ecological systems. So you want more diversity, and diversity of viewpoint, I think that was one of the points that Thomas Jefferson and some of the other writers back in the 18th century wrote, was about the idea of putting together a marketplace of ideas in the commons, in the global commons, where people, the best ideas would actually prevail.
Albert, is there anything else you'd like to tell us about as we wrap up here?
Just that there's always been this dynamic tension in permaculture between the lovable hucksters, and I would say, you know, Bill Mollison, Manasunupu Fukuoka, Jeff Lawton, Sepp Holzer, people who are very good at what they do but tend to oversell the brand a bit by saying how wonderful it will be and how everything will grow better for you if you just use permaculture. And then you've got the people who are actual on-the-ground testers and testing the results, like Peter Harper and Rob Hopkins and David Holmgren, and they're much more scientifically oriented. I would say, you know, that some of them publish in peer review articles, peer review journals, like Howard Odom, Katie Fox, Jenny Pickerell, and Rafter Sass Ferguson. And they're critical of things that don't work. And so really, the challenge going forward is do like David Holmgren and not stick yourself in a place and just firmly plant your feet and never move, but to test your ideas. And if they're not working for you, whether as an individual or as a movement, make a change.
Check out Albert Bates for sure. He travels and he speaks. Find out when he's near you. Make the trip to hear him. It's certainly worth it. Check out Albert's blog and long list of activities from links you can find at peaksurfer.blogspot.ca or from my own show blog at ecoshock.info. From the farm in Tennessee, Albert Bates, thank you so much. It's always a treat talking with you.
Thank you, Al.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Big Picture Radio right now with Alex Smith. Get it all, ecoshock.org.
we are creatures here just like all the others. We didn't create them, and we have no right to destroy them. We're losing species today at, you know, 1,000 times the rate that species do normally go extinct. We are killing off the rest of the creation.
The thing that's at the heart of our daily lives is the abundance of cheap fossil fuel. That's what's made us rich. The problem is that same fossil fuel is now killing us.
When everything is at stake, what is more valuable, answers or questions? We find both in a new film from two self-proclaimed old dogs, filmmakers John Ankeley and Anne McSood. Their new film is The Wisdom to Survive, Climate Change, Capitalism, and Community. Anne joins us now on Radio EcoShock. Welcome.
Thank you, Alex. I'm happy to be on your show, and I'm sorry that John is not with us because he and I have been very much equal partners in dozens and dozens of films for the past 25 years. So I'll speak from my point of view, but he's very much part of the film. I just wanted to say that.
I got it. Well, we can only really talk to one of you at a time, the way my setup is. So there is a progression in this film beyond what I would expect. First, I want to ask you, would you introduce our listeners to the movie? What set you on the path to making The Wisdom to Survive?
Well, I live in Woodstock, Vermont, and in 2011, every summer in July, we have something called Bookstock, which is a festival of authors and books and language. And Bill McKibben was the keynote speaker in 2011, and I was asked to introduce him. And I knew he had a new book out called Earth, and I had resisted reading it. And I thought, I better read this thing if I'm going to introduce him. And so I read the book, and it literally blew my mind. I mean, it was a wake-up call for me, even though I'd been talking about climate change for probably 20 years. It had not really gone deeply into me until I read that book. And I remember sitting next to him in the town hall where he was going to do his talk, and I said, we need to amplify this message. Could we do an interview? And he said yes. And then I thought to myself, well, if one book could change me to that extent and make me determined to spend the rest of my life working on this issue, then maybe a film could change other people. And so it turned out to be way more than an interview with just Bill. It started there, and then we ended up interviewing 23 other people, and the film kind of just developed that way. But that's what started it.
So it was a journey for you. Who are some of the other people woven into this film?
Well, a lot of them are Vermonters, and partly because I live there and have access, but really mainly because Vermont is a very interesting place these days, and there's so much going on in terms of sort of systems of transition into a harder time that we're coming up upon, that I thought that maybe the film could sort of hold Vermont up as a model of what communities can do and regions can do to prepare for the impacts of climate change. So we started there, but that wasn't enough because as we looked at the impacts of climate change in the global south, we felt we had to interview people there, and we felt we had to interview women, especially from the global south. And then we felt like we had to interview Native Americans from our country. And so it just kind of grew. I remember reading that Robert Frost said that his poem, he didn't know the end when he began, and it sort of melted on itself like an ice cube. And there was an element of that in this film. We would interview one person, and then they'd say, well, you better see so-and-so, and then we'd go there, and it kind of developed that way, which is probably part of its strength and also some of its weakness, maybe.
It starts in a place which are sort of the standard problems of environmentalism. We bond with whales, we see nature disappearing, vanishing into tar sands and blown mountaintops. And then it develops far beyond that. But why did you begin there? Did you try and picture people right where they were starting out?
You know, we had about 400 pages of transcript. So where to start? You could almost start anywhere. I think, speaking for myself, I started where my deepest grief is, which is to look at what is happening to life on Earth. You know, I mean, we do start with the whales. And that's not really necessarily even a part of climate change. I mean, it's a small part, but the slaughter of the whales has been going on, and before climate change, we became conscious of that. But it is that disregard for other species or that ability to cause that kind of suffering that I think is the deepest cause of climate change. So I feel as though people are grieving about what's happening to life on Earth. And whether they're aware of it or not, I don't know. I watch at the screenings that we've had. We've had three or four screenings of this film since it came out, and I watch people put their eyes down and look away in the beginning of the film. And I encourage them not to do that, to just look at it in the eye for just the short time that those difficult images are there. There's a woman in the film, she's an environmental teacher from the University of Vermont, and she says, if we fail to really look at the suffering that's happening to the animals and to other species, if we will look at it, then the opportunity for action will arise. And I'm thinking, well, maybe if we don't look at it and really dare to look at it and let it in, then maybe the opportunities for action won't arise. So I think starting there was the place where I start, and John too. But it could have started anywhere.
Well, it's a common problem. I have it too with interviews. Now, Anne McSood, we may both be old dogs. Do you think that makes us more or less sensitive to the idea that climate change is an intergenerational crime?
Alex, I don't know about the sensitivity. I certainly found young people whom we interviewed were passionately sensitive about this. But what I do think about old dogs, I'll include John in that too. He and I are the same age. I feel as though we have the time to really spend working with this. I think the generation under me, my children's generation, are struggling to make ends meet, single parents, all of that, so that we're the ones with the leisure. Have, at least I am a person who doesn't have a 9-to-5 job, and I can spend this time. So more sensitive. I did read a study that Yale put out about the climate project that said that the elders are more engaged in climate change, maybe statistically, but that's not what I found as I went around and interviewed the young people. So I don't know. I don't know whether part of it is also that we've messed things up for them, so we need to be more sensitive.
Well, I got to agree with that. And I think, though, that we've seen what the climate was before, so it's easier for us to register that it has really changed, that it wasn't always this messed up. And I think that's a factor. And we have, too, James Hansen, the famous NASA scientist who wrote the book, really, for his grandchild. I'm motivated by my grandchild. I'm very worried about what's going to happen for his little life.
You know, Bill McKibben says in the film at one point, he said that the world will never be as beautiful as it is today. And he said, and I'm very aware of that, and I pay attention. He said, it's our job to appreciate it and pay attention. And he said, and I do. And I was very moved by that, because that's the way I feel. I feel when we have one spectacularly beautiful day, that they're not going to be that many as we come down the pike. So,
won't science or technology find a way out of this, though? I mean, your guest seems sure that human ingenuity won't pull off a surprise that'll get us out of climate change or the energy problem.
Yes, that was Roger Payne, the whale biologist, who said, I think he was referring to solve the problem of running out of water in Los Angeles. And he said in a kind of mocking way, oh, well, that's no problem. We'll just build a giant desalination plant. And he said, sure, we will if we want to spend the money. And then he talks about how somebody did an estimate of the services that the environment do for us, and that if we added it up, it would come to $30 trillion a year. So I think whether or not science will find some trick to technology and get us out of this, that's not the deeper question. The deeper question is, if we could flip a switch and have all renewable energy exactly at the same extent to which we are energized right now, is that really the way we want to live on the planet? Feels to me that wouldn't be okay. It just feels that excess that we have now would work itself out in some other problems, and that the real question is to reconsider what it means to be alive on the planet and what it means to be a human being as part of this web of life. So I don't know whether the other guests would have said that technology will do it, and I don't know what your other guests have said, but I'm always tempted to wish they would find something that would be magical. I don't know. What do you think?
I don't think so. I think that the problems we're facing are baked into the cake of the technologies we're using. Just look at nuclear power, for example. That was supposed to be the big answer, and it's turned out to be the big problem after Fukushima. I want to say this is Radio Ecoshock. I'm Alex Smith with Anne McSood, talking about her new film, The Wisdom to Survive. And I wonder if it's a cliche or idealization to think that Aboriginal people have answers the rest of us can't see. Tell us about your experiences interviewing Native people in America and in other parts of the world.
I wondered about the fact that we were only interviewing three Native Americans in Arizona, at a reservation in Arizona, and I thought it felt pretty token to me at the time, you know, oh, we have to get the Native Americans in to the film. But when I met them and heard the interviews, we only cut small amounts of it, but the whole interview of each of those three people was very transformative for me. I left there quite changed in realizing that these young people, all three of them were young, they don't have that disconnection that so many of us have from nature. It's just not part of their language. It's already a deep assumption that we're part of this web of life and that if we disturb the energy, then we will be unwell as a species. And when I left, I felt as though I had understood something that for me before had been a cliche, but it helped me. I don't know how it comes across in the film, because we had to go over it quite lightly. The other aspect of it is also that they're dealing with one of the most dreadful impacts of climate change, and that is the shortage of water where they live. So that was the other reason for going there.
It was great to see many young activists and thinkers in this movie, especially the women. Was that a conscious choice for you, and why does that matter?
No, I think it was a conscious choice to make sure we got young people. Because when we started out in Vermont with Gus Speth and Bill McKibben and, you know, the professors from UVM, we had a lot of sort of elder white people, and we knew we needed to get young people in there. And then I think that there's this one young woman in California who was part of reclaiming the commons and taking back some public space from the University of California, and they were planting a big garden illegally. And she said at one point in her interview that a colleague had said, if it's the right thing to do, then we're right to be doing it. And that really struck a chord with me. It's made me much bolder since then about this idea of reclaiming the commons, that this common space belongs to all of us. And, you know, I don't really know whether any of this was a conscious choice, except we knew we needed to see people who were really working in the area of climate change, and we were led to these people.
Well, this whole question of the commons has been going on for hundreds of years, and it was really a fine moment in the film to see people gardening while police officers with badges were filming them doing it. I thought, okay, gardening, the new crime, the new terrorism.
Exactly,
oh,
yeah.
Oh, boy.
And you noticed how ineffectual the police were, really.
Yeah.
You could see they didn't want to be there either.
No, they've got better things to do. Well, look, Anne, the movie title claims to take on capitalism, but I found the section wasn't too clear about what we should do about it. I know it's a huge question to ask, but did you develop a sense that there is an option to capitalism?
Well, you know, even naming capitalism in our subtitle was frowned upon by some who said, oh, you're going to lose a whole audience if you attack capitalism. But I think that we're at a time now where we can't not look at capitalism as a primary cause of everything that's going on. So we wanted to talk about capitalism, and Joel Covell is a person who has written a book called The End of Nature, The Enemy of Nature, The End of Capitalism, or The End of the World. And I feel as though until we take a real good look at capitalism and not just tweaking it or regulating it, but looking at it as a system that is failing then I think we'll never work our way out of this mess. I'm not sure we will anyway, but certainly we won't if we don't come to terms with the causes of climate change, which is this industrial growth society. I guess alternatives to capitalism is the big problem. And I'm guessing, Alex, that's why, you know, year after year after year, nothing really changes. Maybe we don't know what to do if we don't have a system like capitalism. Or what do we do if capitalism, as Joanna Macy in the film suggests, is collapsing and destroying itself at the core? Well, what kind of chaos will that provide? So in trying to figure out how I'm going to deal with that, I've just gotten super local in my own community and think maybe that the other system, at least during this transition, will be just to hunker down locally and work on local food systems and local economies. But I don't know. It's a huge question and one that can kind of make you pretty hopeless sometimes because people don't want to tamper with capitalism, and also that, you know, it's hard to decouple that from democracy. Those two things are put together in people's minds. So it's been a tough one.
Well, speaking of decoupling, we know that wealth is accumulating rapidly in the hands of just a few people. In one statistic, just 85 people control the same wealth as the poorest half of all the rest of the people on Earth. Is this process of accumulation at the top just a historic trend that runs parallel to climate change, or do you feel that the two are very linked?
Yeah, I feel like they're essentially linked. I saw that statistic, too. I think that was just yesterday or the day before. Did you just read that?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it took a while for that to sink in. 85 people and 4.5 billion people. I mean, that is so monumentally unfair that how could it not be linked to the collapse of civilization and the collapse of the world around us? Yes, I think they're entirely linked.
Well, we seem to have this fossil-burning machine. I mean, our suburbs are machines that burn, our cities are, our lives are, I'm doing it too. That seems to be almost what we do for a living, is just take things out of the ground and throw them up into the atmosphere. So as long as that's part of the wealth accumulation process, they're not going to stop it. They're making money out of it, whether it's oil companies or the tar sands or whatever. Too much money being made, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're not going to stop, and Stephanie Kazet deals with that in the movie, talking about some of the things that may come, like more resource wars and more of a fascist state. I agree. She said we're not going to give that up lightly. But I wonder if Joanna Macy isn't right. I mean, if she, Joanna Macy, who's going to be 85 her next birthday, and she's if some of your listeners don't know her, she's a eco-philosopher and a Buddhist scholar. She's said she'd love to retire, but there's just much too much to do. So she does workshops and writes. And anyway, she thinks that there's no need to go attack capitalism because it's quickly collapsing. So I would think that a symptom of that collapse would be that statistic that you just said. How long can we go on this way? So maybe there won't be some kind of conscious choice to change our ways, but our ways are going to change.
Right. Well, going to the voices towards the end of the film, what's the role of permaculture, and do you really think we can feed the world on that?
Oh, you have that wonderful Vermonter, Ben Falk, who's got a wonderful permaculture organization going on. And it was a relief to film him because it was so positive. But, of course, I had the thought was, well, how many people can you feed with this little farm? I'm sure you've had guests who are experts on this. I don't think there's been that much research on how are we going to feed ourselves. And I looked up to see that many grants are being given now for people to study regional food systems and how will we have food security. I mean, it's one of my worst nightmares if I allow myself to think about the hunger that's happening and the food refugees that we're going to have. So do I think permaculture can solve it? Theoretically, I would think that if everybody grew food in their own region, that it could feed that region. But I don't know what the studies would show. It feels like an impossible situation.
We are in an impossible situation, but we have to carry on anyway. Who do you think this film is for? Is it for those who already know about these issues or for those who don't know about these issues?
Well, first of all, when I first wanted to make it, it was going to be for people who hadn't awakened to this yet, as I had not really on some deep level. So it was going to be to wake people up and recruit them to become part of the solution and to become active and to not turn away anymore. But as I've worked with the film over the past year and a half, I've realized that it may be more useful for the people who already know, because what we found in our first several screenings is that people appreciate so much the fine line between despair and, I won't say hope, because hope is discussed in the film, and as Joanna Macy said, you know, when you're in the middle of an adventure, you don't have time to figure out whether you feel hopeless or hopeful. But what was hopeful for me was to be in the company of people who haven't given up and who are loving their lives in spite of this catastrophe and who are happy and celebrative and who laugh a lot, and yet their whole lives are dedicated to this issue. So I think it's for both. I wait to see, because it's just so newly out that we haven't had enough feedback about how it can be used.
Okay, so how do listeners find out more about your new movie?
All right. Well, as you said, as you already introduced me as an old dog, we're olddogdocumentaries.org, and it's on our homepage, and the educational buyers from universities will be clicked over to Bullfrog Films. They've picked up the film. And then people who want to buy it for their own church groups or community screenings or for home use will stay on our website.
That sounds good. We've been talking with filmmaker Anne McSood with her partner John Ankeley. She's released the movie The Wisdom to Survive, Climate Change, Capitalism, and Community. You can find links to that also in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Anne, thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure talking with you. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio. For the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Rochelle Van Zanten is an up-and-coming songwriter and performer from Canada's West Coast. A while back, we played her anthem, My Country, and it talks down the office-bound folks far away that make terrible decisions about her land. She's fed up with people ramming through pipelines and tar sands into pristine First Nations country. Rochelle, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
Well, now, before we talk about activist music, I have to ask, where the heck are you?
I am actually in the central interior of British Columbia. So if you are in Vancouver and you drive north about 13 hours, you'll hit me.
That's out there. And when I got in touch, you had to walk down the hill for a phone. Are you living off-grid?
I am, yeah. I have a little 400 square feet cabin off-grid. It's actually one that my grandfather built in 1951. And we just live off of the sun, and there's no sun right now. So in order to call you, I had to borrow my dad's phone, which is hooked up to the hydro. So,
right, you are. Okay, now you, in your music, you have a unique blend of your heritage, your sense as a woman, and activism to protect the land. How did you get started in that direction?
Well, you know, I started out writing music at early age, so my teens, and then 18 years of age, I joined a rock band called Painting Daisies, and we were all about original music, and we started touring all over the world. And of course, as a teenager, I'm writing about things about me and very egoistic, self-centered kind of stuff, which is great. And then, you know, I think 10 years in, I came home back to my roots, back to Francois Lake, British Columbia, and just realized how tied I am to the seasons and how tied I am to my land. And it was making me sick not having that tie while I was on the road. It's all I could think about. It's all I could focus on and write about. And especially just all the current things that have been happening, being bombarded by all these projects, these proposals to extract resources, to start up mines, to put pipelines through. And, you know, you're just a product of your environment. So I'm hit on all sides by these things. And I can't help but that be my main focus on lyrics.
Do you have the feeling that oil executives somewhere far away are just kind of using things up?
I think the big thing is that they're not here. And so as soon as you actually get them here and perhaps immerse them in your life, your culture. It believe it or not, it does make a difference, because I think a lot of them are just unaware, and they live in the city where they buy food from a grocery store. And as soon as you actually show them that our, you know, my life, my people, everyone here, we depend on the fish, we depend on the land. My father grows food for the world, and he needs clean water and clean land to do so. And so as soon as they see that, it's amazing what happens, the transition.
I've found that the guitar work and the overall production in your songs is really, really good. Where are you recording?
I actually head south to Victoria, and I record at Baker Studios, which is a beautiful studio right in a 10-acre arbutus heaven. It's gorgeous, and I use Joby Baker as my musical compadre, my musical brother and producer, and he's done the last four records for me, and just a great experience. He's like your super positive life coach, and so it makes an awesome product in the end.
And so what are the last two albums that you have out there?
The last two, 2009 was an album called Where Your Garden Grows, which was written on the road, and I spent basically all my entire year on the road, all over India, all over England, the rest of Europe, Canada, United States, and I was touring with this great backing, this great rhythm section from Oxford. And so you can hear that in the music. It's very influenced by wherever we were in the world and these great players. And then the latest one, which just came out in May of 2013, is called Oh Mother. And I recorded it with Joby Baker. He played the drums, bass, Hammond, whatever he could get his hands on, strings, and I played everything else and sang and wrote the music. And it's very influenced by my life the last 2 years, 3 years, basically growing my own food again. I became a mother. I lost my mother. Just paying homage to Mother Earth. It's very rooted in, yeah, you can definitely hear Francois Lake in it.
Definitely. Well, looking at iTunes, tell us about what are maybe two hot songs that are really moving.
Well, you know, I Fight for Life is really popular right now because it seems to be the anthem of what's going on with the pipelines, with oil tankers, with all these projects that are, you know, threatening cultural genocide in our land. And so I Fight for Life is not a despairing song. It gives people hope that they're, you know, we do have a voice, and this is why. Because we're strong in numbers and we're deeply rooted to this land and willing to protect it no matter what. So I would say I Fight for Life. And then secondly, I would choose off the new album, the Canoe Song, which has a similar theme and features Lillian Moyer, one of the Tahltan elders, who has been arrested 13 times protecting her traditional territory from oil and gas companies, from mining companies. She lays it on the line, and she's actually lit my fire, you know, giving me the strength to want to do the same for my watershed.
Do you have a website to tell us about?
Yes, my website is rachellevanzanten.com, and rachellevanzanten.com. And you can hear music on there. There's lots of great press reviews and photos from past tours and lots of fun stuff. And actually, YouTube, there's a lot of really great videos that are my band playing all over the world, which is kind of neat, too.
We've been talking with Rachelle Van Zanten. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
And thank you.
Okay, now let's listen to her music.
Reminded me that I can fly. With my own 2 feet, I chased the current for the victory. It reminded me that I can fly. Ooh. We are hunters, we are trappers with a reverent vision. Now I stand here with a child inside. She is growing with her roots drawn down to the water from a river that is fighting for life. Charlie loves the rain that falls down through the fits of thunder. We fish the lake for what we need to grow. When When I look into her eyes, I see Aurora dancing. We're alive here and they need to know. With all my weapons down and in a peaceful manner, I defend the land they cannot hide from dirty policy made by the ones who squander. While leaders fight for oil, I fight for life. For tired from looking for the way back home. Delete the colors one by one and leave the washed out places. Can't eat money and they can't drink oil. With all my weapons down and in a peaceful manner, I defend the land they cannot hide from dirty policies made by the ones who squander. While leaders fight for oil, I fight for life. I fight for life. I fight for life. I fight for life.
That was Rochelle Van Zanten. The website for this program is ecoshock.org. Find links for the show in my weekly blog at ecoshock.info. This is Radio EcoShock, and right now, I'm grateful. Thanks to you and your support for this program, I talk with scientists, authors, activists, and artists around the world, and I feel I do it on your behalf. It's the opportunity of a lifetime while humanity and our kindred species face the greatest challenges imaginable. Please join me again next week for that journey.
There are bones washing up on the shoreline from the mother of a dying clue. She's been crying since the 1950s. I paddle my canoe to you. Oh yeah, I hear the faraway drum.